yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today the main topic is going to be, what is financial imperialism and how is it doing its dirty work in Venezuela? For that, however, I want to just point out some issues in the global economy as updates that should be kept in mind as we move into the coming weeks here. So let's just jump into this round robin thing and talk about that a little bit, and then we'll move on to financial imperialism and Venezuela. Okay, Brexit deadline coming up, right? Interesting what's going on over there. Well, I've been predicting for a long time there will not be a hard Brexit. They'll just keep kicking the can down the road. And, of course, in the last day or so, the news and the rumors are that Theresa May, Prime Minister of the UK, is going to get a 90-day extension, and the EU will agree to it. So they're going to just continue negotiating here, trying to find a formula. And the longer they go, the closer they get to forcing what the British national capitalists really want, which is a second referendum. Closer they get to that. Okay, so the EU will bend. European Union will bend, I predict here. Their real economy is absolutely flat. Officially, it's probably already in recession. Even the big guns of the Eurozone, Germany, and coming close on behind it, well, Italy's already in recession, France too, getting close. But very clearly, the economy in Europe is in a deep funk. I'm talking about the real economy. And all this talk about the European Central Bank stopping its QE, free money injections into the economy later in the year, nonsense. In fact, it's already becoming clear that they're going to pump even more money through another conduit into the European economy because the banks are in Europe are in deep trouble. The ECB, European Central Bank, is soon going to issue or reissue long-term loans to banks, ultra-long-term loans to banks, because its previous LTRO, as they called it, long-term operations to banks that were initiated in 2011-12, double-dip recession and debt crisis in Europe, are now coming due next year and the year after. So they got to roll those over, or those companies are going to go under, and that's what they're going to do. Even more loans to the banks in order to keep the failures, defaults, from escalating here very soon. You know, the European Central Bank pumped in $3 trillion, equivalent of euros, $3 trillion. And they're already, even though they announced they weren't adding more, well, they're just rolling over the prior loans that are coming due, so they're still increasing. And that, you know, that's what the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank did. It announced it wasn't increasing QE after $4.5 trillion debt load. But as the bonds, some of the bonds came due in 2016-17, they just kept rolling them over. Excuse me, 2014-15-16, they kept rolling them over. So they kept putting more money into the economy as it came due. And the $4.5 trillion U.S. official QE debt load is really over $5 trillion, maybe $6 trillion that they pumped in the economy. Well, the European Central Bank, ECB, is doing the same thing because the banks are in deep trouble over in Europe, and the economy is either absolutely flat or declining and will continue to. So the real economy is flat and in heading into recession, and their banks are in big trouble. They've never been bailed out. Non-performing bank loans, hundreds of billions, maybe trillions of dollars, never bailed out. And what banks are in trouble? Well, you hear a lot about Deutsche Bank. They're in trouble. But now reports coming out and some data coming out that other big banks, besides the Italian, Greek banks that are clearly in trouble, you know, but other banks like the French and the Swiss banks, BNP Paribas, big losses, layoffs, Credit Suisse, UBS. These are all in trouble now. And even early cracks appearing in the big giant UK global bank, HSBC, although it's early there. So across the board, the European banks are in trouble. The economy is flat and declining. And the EU is terrified about a hard Brexit and what it might mean for the increasingly fragile financial system and an economy. And the same thing is happening in the UK, of course. The economy is going south and banks are in trouble, not as seriously as on the continent. That's why they will have an agreement. They'll kick the can down the road till they get some kind of a face-saving agreement. Or they'll just keep kicking the can down the road till they get a second referendum. Okay, so that's Brexit. That's my prediction and the picture in Europe. China. Okay, we've been talking a lot about the China trade war with the U.S. and what the issues are, those three big issues, right? Remember that? Three big issues, U.S. access to a majority ownership of U.S. companies in China. China's agreed to that already. U.S. Demands that China buy more of U.S. goods, particularly farm goods. China's agreed to that already, $1 trillion more over the next 4 or 5 years. 51% plus ownership of U.S. corporations. So the bankers got what they want, you know, and the Midwest will get what it wants. But the Pentagon, U.S. Pentagon, and military-industrial complex is really concerned over China technology. So technology transfer of U.S. corporations in China is an issue. And as a corollary of that, China companies like Huawei and others buying subsidiaries in the U.S. and elsewhere, Canada and Europe, as a backdoor to get U.S. technology transfer. So there's two directions here for tech transfer. That's an issue. And the U.S., that's why the U.S. is playing hardline, using sanctions against Huawei and twisting the arms of U.S. allies, Canada and Britain and so forth, to stop Huawei, which is their big telecom company, right, from doing business. But it's not working so well. There's big cracks in this sanctions approach against Huawei. Germany says no. That means the rest of Europe will say no. India says no. So cracks are beginning to appear in that, despite the sanctions by Trump and threats of sanctions by Trump. So that's still the big issue that's being negotiated. And the U.S. wants some written guarantees from China about tech transfer. You know, they call it intellectual property rights because a lot of this is software written. We're going to see what happens in negotiations now underway, because we have a deadline here as well. Deadline of March 1st. You know, and if it doesn't happen by March 1st, an agreement, the understanding was by Trump when he extended the U.S. $200 billion more U.S. tariffs on China imports 90 days ago, roughly, you know, that the tariffs would rise from 10% 25% on $200 billion more of Chinese goods effective March 1st. Well, I've always predicted that there will be an agreement here between the U.S. and China for the same reasons that we see a softening of the economy in Europe, and there will be an agreement on Brexit. The U.S. economy and the Chinese economy are both slowing, and that's the big motivation. And, of course, Trump needs a big win here with the Mueller report coming out. He needs a big win on trade, and we'll see how far he's willing to bend and how far the military-industrial complex, Pentagon, U.S., will push back to get tougher technology agreements. But I predict there will be agreement. It won't be on March 1st. They'll extend that as well, deadline, and already in the last few days we see Trump signaling he will extend it. There will be an agreement by the summer, and we'll see what the terms and conditions of that agreement will be. But as both economies, China, U.S., soften, the pressure grows for an agreement, and they will get an agreement. A couple interesting new twists have appeared recently in the demands of the U.S. Apart from the three major demands, the U.S. in negotiations are demanding that China stop subsidizing its state-owned enterprises. Well, you see, that's tied in with this whole thing of U.S. corporate access. If U.S. corporations are going to do business by themselves in China, they're going to be competing against state-owned enterprises for lending in particular, and for those markets in China. And they're complaining that China subsidizes the costs of its state-owned enterprises, and therefore they can charge lower prices, and that's unfair competition, right? Well, when you got state-owned enterprises, you don't tax your state-owned enterprises. I mean, that's useless paperwork. What you do is allow them to charge lower prices because you're not taxing them, you see? So, yes, there's subsidization going on in China because they're state-owned enterprises and their prices are lower because there's no tax load. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. Is China interesting that in this whole affair, they're talking about subsidization? U.S. is talking about subsidization? Well, wait a minute. The U.S. subsidizes its corporations as well. It just does it through the tax system. For example, one of the biggest companies, Amazon, $11 trillion, I believe, in revenues, not profits, revenues, $11 trillion, and pays no taxes. Well, isn't that subsidization? Well, sure it is. Through the tax code. Well, you know, that's very interesting, isn't it? That these nationalized industries are more efficient than U.S. corporations? Well, that runs counter to all the ideology about capitalist efficiency, doesn't it? And they're also pressing for China, the U.S. is, to make sure that they don't devalue their currency, the yuan, and just offset the advantage, you know, that the U.S. negotiates here, and written agreements on technology. Well, we'll see what happens. We'll probably have more to report on next show on the China trade war, but once again, I've always predicted there'll be an agreement, and there won't be any big crisis deadline here, just as there isn't with Brexit. Let's talk a little bit about the U.S. economy here, just some add-ons. You know, last week we talked about retail sales at the end of 2018 looking very serious, haven't we? Yeah, well, now that we got some housing data here on the economy. Prior home sales, 3 months in a row at the close of last year, prices declining. In January as well, prior home sales fell 1.2% in January alone. So we got a price deflation going on in the residential housing markets. Really slow. The sector is really slow. Construction construction declined every quarter over prior quarter last year in 2018. Residential construction, every quarter, declined. And commercial construction began declining in the second half with a lag. So the housing sector is going south, as well as retail sales. And industrial production and business investment, the same thing. At the end of last year, 4 out of the last 5 months, new orders for non-defense capital equipment declined. In December, a 0.7% decline, fourth month in a row. So clearly, business equipment spending was 8.5% in the first quarter of 2018, but the third quarter was down two-thirds, just a little over 3%. I don't know what the fourth quarter is yet. I haven't seen the data, but I presume it's probably close to 1% or 1%, 2% or less. Continues to slow. So business investment, new orders, manufacturing, new orders, durable goods, commercial construction, residential construction, home prices, all of these are retail sales are all going south pretty fast. Well, some of that has to do with the Fed continually raising rates last year. And the market saw this, you know, saw the data and had a big hiccup there in November, December. And the stock market declined like 30%. The S&P 500, the Dow, right? Serious decline, scared the hell out of them. So immediately the Fed stopped raising rates. Yeah, which kind of puts to bed this fiction that the Fed never changes policy because of financial markets, only the real economy. Yeah, nonsense. The Fed stopped because of the contraction in the financial markets, which was a reflection of realization of what's going on in the real U.S. economy. Nonetheless, the latest report from the Fed says, oh, the economy's in good shape. It's slowing a little bit. It's in good shape. You believe that? I don't. Almost daily in the business press, we get reports about financial fragility. Oh, watch out for leveraged loans. Oh, watch out for the junk bonds. Watch out for triple B investment grade loans, which are really mostly junk loans. One half of all investment grade loans now are the lowest quality triple B, which is, you know, one step above junk. And yet the stock market quickly recovered, but not fully. You know, it's up 19% since the beginning of the year and the Fed decision to stop raising rates. Well, it was down more than 30%. So we're ratcheting down here. And there's going to be another third big contraction in 2019. So get your money out of the stock market. Okay. You know, and put this all in context of the Trump massive tax cuts for investors and businesses and bankers and so forth. Massive. Has it stimulated the economy? I don't know. It looks like the economy's slowing nonetheless, despite this massive free money. And as I've said, this all this free money is not going into the real economy, and the data I just gave you show it's not going into the real economy. So where's it all going? Well, it's going back into the stock market to prop it up. Is it stock buybacks, dividend payouts, mergers and acquisitions activity offshore? That's where all the money is going or being just hoarded. You know, corporate profits, Fortune 500 corporate profits last year, up 27%. Studies show that 22% was due simply to the Trump tax cuts hitting the bottom line. So the profits would have been less than 10% last year if it wasn't for the Trump tax cuts. You see, they're subsidizing these guys. The government policy is subsidizing it. Under Obama, the subsidization was the free money, zero interest rates virtually. Okay, the Fed had to start raising rates here because they knew recession was coming, And it knew there were huge deficits that had to fund by selling bonds. You got to raise rates to sell more bonds. So it reversed after Obama monetary policy, but the subsidization took the form of fiscal policy, tax cuts by Trump. And that's why we've got trillion-dollar deficits out as far as the eye can see. It's going to be interesting how the Fed can finance all of those deficits without raising rates now to sell more bonds, especially since it's clear that the Chinese and Russians are and others are slowly but progressively reducing their purchase of U.S. Treasuries. And other countries may start doing the same. So they got to sell more. They, Fed, has to sell more bonds to finance these huge deficits and debt in the U.S. How's it going to do it without raising interest rates? It's going to be an interesting contradiction. Let's see how it gets resolved. You know, it's not just BBB and leveraged loans and junk bonds that our warnings are coming out every day. Now I saw one about insurance companies, which are banks, of course. Warnings about the big insurance companies from the auditing firm Fitch, AIG, MetLife. Warnings. Why? Because they've been increasing their portfolio of these triple B and junk bonds holdings. So if the triple B market and junk bond market go south again, and the junk bond market almost came to a standstill late last year, they couldn't sell any junk bonds at some point. Well, that's going to happen again. And you see, what I'm describing is a contagion mechanism here, from these very fragile markets to the institutions. And since all the institutions are linked to each other, financial institutions, they topple like dominoes once it occurs. So warning about insurance companies, big insurance companies. Well, wasn't AIG at the heart of the last crisis in 2008? Yes. All right. So, and MetLife and AIG were once considered by the government, what do you call it, strategic financial institutions. Well, they've been removed from that, and therefore they don't have to pay as close attention to keeping sufficient buffers in the event there is a crisis. They let them off the hook. And they're getting worse. The situation's getting worse. Okay, so that's the U.S. economy. Right? Contrary to the Fed report, increasingly, both in real terms, real markets, retail sales, housing, investment, so forth, in trouble, and on the financial side, and becoming increasingly fragile. Now, a minute ago, I said the Fortune 500 corporations had a 27% profit increase, 22% due to Trump tax cuts. Data just came out that the U.S. banks, the big banks, the traditional banks, you know, the Chases and so forth, 44% increase in their profits last year. Twice that of other corporations, non-financial corporations. 44% profit increase. How much of that was due? How much of that was due to the Trump tax cuts? Some of it was due to the Fed raising interest rates, because the banks benefit interest income when the rates rise. They get to charge higher rates, but they don't increase the rates that they pay you and I for putting their money with them. No, no. Okay, so that's the U.S. economy. And the China economy, you know, is increasingly in trouble, slowing down. You know, China since 2015 has been embroiled in this what I call whack-a-mole dilemma. Yeah, they stimulate the economy through fiscal and monetary policy injections, People's Bank of China, the central bank, massive money injections, just like the Fed and the ECB. as a way to stimulate the economy, and they combine that with fiscal spending because the state policy is the government invests directly a lot, unlike here. That's been able to keep the Chinese economy growing or not slowing as fast as in the West. But all that free money is a big impetus to China's shadow banking and speculating side of its economy. So they stimulate the economy whenever it slows down, put money in. That creates more speculation and shadow banks grow. Financial markets become more fragile, particularly housing markets, you know, and asset management markets. And then China said, oh, we got a growing problem of debt. That's the indicator of the growth of these shadow banks. Right? And, oh, we got to do something about it. So they slow down their stimulus, right? And that slows down the real economy at the expense of trying to do something about the shadow banks and the speculators in China. So they go back and forth. Well, when it slows down too much, they pump money back into the economy, right? That relieves the pressure on the shadow banks and the speculators, and we're back again, you know, to that dilemma and vice versa. This has gone on since 2015, since the crash of their stock market in 2015. Yeah. So President Xi of China, you know, announced in 2017, we're going to go after the shadow banks and the speculators, and they did, and slowed their economy down, and now they're pumping it back up again. The People's Bank of China, last year, I believe it is five reductions, what's called a reserve requirement. In other words, the amount of money that banks had to hold as a cushion, right? The reserve requirement, you reduce that, gives the banks more money to loan out and more speculators and so forth. So you got this problem of whack-a-mole back and forth. You know, you're going to whack the speculators and the shadow banks, and that's going to slow your economy. Okay, economy slows, let's pump it back up. Here come the shadow banks and the speculators, and they've been going on again and off again and on again and off again, but they've been slowing down in the process of all that. You know, back in the early part of this decade, 2011-12, when China engaged in a major stimulus, fiscal stimulus, protect itself from the crash, the global crash in 2008-09, which it did effectively, pumping money, $3, for every $3 equivalent of yuan, for every $4 equivalent, they got $3 of GDP real growth. Pretty efficient. Well, now data shows that they got to pump in $4 to get $1 of real growth. So the effectiveness of fiscal monetary policy is declining significantly in China, and that's why it's slowing down. Well, that's true everywhere in the global economy. Monetary policy is becoming less and less effective, as I pointed out in my book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. And as I said earlier this show, you know, ECB is about to inject even more. Not going to have much effect on the slowdown in Europe. Okay. And also watch, briefly, we're now getting some indication that India banks are in trouble. I think they're the second largest holder of non-performing loans globally. And there's growing problems with their shadow banks and speculators in the real estate market over there. We've got real estate price deflation in Mumbai and elsewhere going on right now, and shadow banks in trouble who've been financing most of this. Yes, the shadow banks, you say, unregulated, push the housing markets increasingly everywhere globally. And we may have a classic housing bust coming over there in India as well. But housing prices are in retreat globally, from Australia to the UK to, you know, Abu Dhabi and so forth, right? So that's a sign that the global economy is getting weaker. Okay, so that's the sort of round robin I want to talk about here for this past week, and we'll be talking and watching more about the China-U.S. trade negotiations next week, as well as the U.S. indicators for the U.S. economy, which continually began to show trouble here. And, of course, Brexit will be an interesting topic that sideshow that will continue going on as well. But I want to shift now and talk about financial imperialism, and specifically as it applies to the case of Venezuela we see going on today. You know, classic imperialism is about conquest, right? You know, in ancient times and not so ancient times, the more powerful state would conquer a subject state and drag off all the booty that might exist in that state. You know, all the things of value. You know, all its precious metals and its artifacts made of the same, and its, you know, herds of animals and so forth, and of course herds of people who they would drag off as slaves and take them back. And that was how imperialism, you know, in ancient times actually functioned. Mm-hmm. Kind of a one-time sweep in and grab everything you can and take it back. Well, then it got a little smarter under the Romans and others, and they set up annual tribute. In other words, instead of sending the army in every year or thereabouts to strip everything, you know, it's expensive to pay an army, so you just say, okay, we're going to threaten you if you don't give us more the next year and the year after that and the year after that. So organized tribute. And it was an easy step going from organized tribute demands to setting up actual bureaucratic apparatuses, and that's colonialism, right? And that's, you know, typically what Europe did, you know, after the 15th century, particularly in the New World, Spain, Portugal, and others, England, and afterwards as well, you know, in Asia and India and so forth, the Europeans set up, Africa set up these colonies with a bureaucracy and a certain amount of military presence there. The British were very clever, and particularly in the case of India, they were able to use local elites in an alliance and pretty much dominate and control. The whole purpose of European imperialism during this period was clearly to extract the wealth that could be produced in these countries. A lot of these countries' colonies, had a lot of natural resources that Europe didn't have, and they could set up, in addition, the Europeans' manufacturing to produce the goods there in these countries cheaply, and then ship the goods back to the home country of the empire and resell them at a higher price. You see, produce it real low, resell at a higher price, both within their country and to the other colonies that it had. This is classic British imperialism. That's how it worked, and all the Europeans, classic. And the U.S. got into that kind of a game late, you know, when it, War of 1898, when it conquered countries that were, you know, Philippines and Caribbean, Central America, places like that. So the U.S. was a participant in that kind of classical imperialism, right? Set up a big colonial apparatus in the Philippines, for example. But the whole purpose of that was to force the locals to mine whatever, you know, the precious metal was, or the resource was, and at virtually low cost. And they would then steal that and send that back and resell it, or then get the locals to manufacture the goods, you see. And the whole idea is exploitation, you see. That's what that's all about. When you steal the resources and you steal the labor of the locals by charging them subsistence, or paying them subsistence wages and pretty much stealing everything, what you're doing is paying them minimal of the market value of the goods they produce or the resources they have, right? And that difference, that surplus difference, you know, that amounts to the exploitation. So imperialism is always about exploitation. In the 21st century, however, imperialism and exploitation is taking on more and more a financial form, financial, instead of colonial apparatuses, which are expensive, and you know, posting armed forces in these countries, which is expensive, you can do it financially. Well, what do we mean financially? Well, if the whole idea is to extract surplus from these countries, well, you do it by debt. You get these countries indebted. You integrate their banking and financial system with your own, and you give the local elites a taste of the profits, you see, and they cooperate, and they go ahead and ensure the extraction and exploitation on behalf of the imperial power. No colonial administration, therefore no costs. Local capitalists share in the booty extraction. The surplus that's produced is increased. How is the surplus increased? Well, it's increased by austerity, you see. Instead of exploiting factory by factory or mine by mine, you get the whole society organized to extract. And the local banks and governments participate in the whole process as a kind of bill collector for the imperial power. Well, take the case of Greece. I wrote a book, Loot in Greece. It's all about the exploitation going on even within the Eurozone of the smaller economies in the periphery, southern periphery, on behalf of the banks and the bigger economies in Northern Europe. Well, austerity means, okay, whatever you produce, your whole labor force produces, the surplus cannot be respent in fiscal policy, fiscal programs, you know, raising pensions, health care, and so forth. No, that surplus has to be repaid to the bankers in the imperial center or the government, pan-state government across states like the European Commission, European Central Bank, on behalf of those banks. As I pointed out in my book, very clearly, 95% of all the surplus, austerity-driven, extracted from Greece, went to Northern European banks, 95%. That's not my study. That's a study by think tanks in Germany. Academics, academic think tank, right? 95%. It's much more efficient. Financial imperialism is more efficient. A greater amount can be extracted through austerity programs and policies. The whole working society gets exploited, not manufacturing company by company or mine by mine. The whole process and the local elites and institutions, governments and banks, are the conduit. They participate in this because they get a cut, a nice cut. And therefore, the imperial power does not have to impose a colonial administration. That's how financial imperialism works in the 21st century. And the local states and governments cannot exercise their own monetary policy. They can't have their own currency. They rely on the currency of the imperial center. They can't engage in their own fiscal policy. They don't have their own true independent banking system. And the whole system works to exploit through austerity a greater surplus that is then used to pay interest on the debt, you see, interest on the debt owed the Imperial Center. Okay, so what financial, you know, that's the basic core explanation. There's a lot of private involvers, you know, hedge funds and so forth involved in the whole process of extraction. What financial markets are we talking about? Well, stock markets, bond markets, exchange markets, gold markets, commodity futures markets like oils, derivative markets, bank lending, government-to-government loans. These are all financial markets. And this is the structure that's used to extract the surplus from the society at large. All right, let's turn to Venezuela. Right. Financial imperialism of the 21st century can be used to take over an economy. It's used to administer the process of general social exploitation I just described, in the case of Greece example. Lots of other cases globally. But it's also used when any of these local country participants in the whole financial structure dominated and controlled by the empire power, whenever these local elements of the global financial structure attempt to break off and go independent and not be part of the whole apparatus, well, then financial imperialism can be used to bring them to heel. Regime change, right? And we see that is what's going on in Venezuela. It's regime change. And at the heart of it has been financial imperialism by the United States. Now, the regime change does not rely totally on financial imperialism, financial means. It resorts, in addition and when necessary, to more direct, even military means, you see, bureaucratic military means. They pull out all the plugs here, right? I'm not saying that imperialism only functions financially, yeah, politically and militarily still, but it relies increasingly on financial means because the global capitalist economy has become financialized in the 21st century. The more market value is created, and destroyed, by the way, through the financial system than it is through investing in real things, making real things. Okay, so what are some of the tactics, the financial tactics that we see going on U.S. versus Venezuela trying to produce regime change, which is accelerated in the past year? As the neocons have come back with a vengeance in the Trump administration. I'm talking about the Boltons and Pompeos, you know, and Lighthizers and all these guys. These are the neons. Remember, the neons got us in the Iraq war, and they're back doing their dirty work. Financial tactics have been used against Venezuela for some time. Well, now, what are these financial tactics? Right. We're not talking about just exploitation here because, you know, since the Chavez Revolution, Venezuela has broken away out of the network here, you know, just like Cuba has and just like some of the other states have. They're not part of that exploitation network. And by the way, after Venezuela, if they succeed, they'll go after Cuba and Nicaragua. Okay, so again, financial tactics. Well, you manipulate the currency. You destroy the currency of the attempted breakaway state. And there's lots of ways to do that, and the U.S. is doing all of them, and has been for several years now. You manipulate the flow, the money flows in and out of the country. In both directions, you take actions to reduce the flow of investments into the country and lending into the country, as well as the attempts to, for capital to flow out of the country. And then you manipulate the local markets, the goods and services markets as well, right? Goods flows in and out. Okay, so let's peel the onion a little further here. What is the U.S. doing to destroy, and has been doing, to destroy the currency of Venezuela, the Bolivar? Well, fundamentally, what you do is deprive the economy of dollars. You see, dollars are the global trading currency, dollars. You know, this is called dollar imperialism. And guess who controls dollars? It's the United States. It's their currency. So the U.S. takes action to make sure dollars don't flow into Venezuela, and the dollars in Venezuela are flow out. So there's a shortage of dollars in the country. If there's a shortage of dollars, and the dollar is the global trading currency, the local currency of the country collapses. A shortage of dollars means the value of the dollar rises, you know, accelerating, rises rapidly in those countries. Well, exchange rates are always, you know, one currency to the other currency. And in this case, it's the dollar is the one currency because it's global, and the Bolivar is the other currency. So if dollars go up rapidly, the value of Bolivars go down just as rapidly. So the U.S. takes action to make sure there's a dollar shortage in Venezuela. It puts pressure on U.S. corporations there to remove their currency, their dollars, don't make them available, and make them unavailable to expand their businesses down there and require them to, you know, whatever dollars they have on hand to repatriate them back to the United States, right? It puts pressure on banks, private banks, and other governments not to make loans in dollars to Venezuela. You know, if it lend them in dollars, then, you know, more dollars would exist in Venezuela. That would, you know, contravene the whole strategy I just described, right? So you put the quash on banks and international banks and international institutions like the IMF lending money, World Bank lending money to Venezuela as it seeks to get more dollars because there's a shortage. And you see, when the Bolivar collapses and the dollar rises, well, economies like Venezuela can't import necessary food and medicines because you've got to pay for them in dollars, you see. And if you don't got the dollars, you can't buy them. And if you can't buy the medicines and the food, then there's shortages in those commodities, those goods as well, and their prices rise. Shortages, right, are engineered through the currency. And, of course, if there's shortages, then the populace is going to be discontent, and that's what you want. The U.S. has even gone so far as to set up investment operations in Colombia to encourage middle-class Venezuelans to move their money, their dollars, out of Venezuela into Colombia. That's been going on for some time. So that squeezes the dollar, the dollar supply even further. So corporations, international lenders, right, the middle class, move all the money out. Get global banks, U.S. at the lead, to deny the ability of Venezuelan companies to issue bonds. You know, when you issue a bond, you give the bond to whoever the investor is, and they give you money, right? So stop the underwriting of bonds by investment banks in the case of Venezuela and Venezuela companies, right? Right. Dump Bolivars on the market as much as you can through U.S. corporations and others there, right? Another tactic is to freeze assets, and we've seen that just happen here. You know, Citgo, the Venezuela oil company, doing business for a long time with refineries in the U.S., in the Northeast, and so forth, is a source of dollars flowing, its profits, and so forth. Well, the U.S. simply seized Citgo, seized it, just grabbed it, took it over. Talk about international law violations, you know, it just shows you the Imperial Center doesn't give a damn about international law, right? It just seized those assets and is giving those assets, the flow, the money flow, the profit flow, revenue flow of Citgo, to its opposition, hand-picked opposition candidates. This Guido guy, where he comes out of nowhere, right? Talk about a puppet, you know, Guido, you know, and quote the opposition. Well, behind Guido is this guy Lopez, you know, in house arrest, and he was really pulling the strings. He's really the key guy here. But Guido is the, you know, out on the street. So Guido is the key guy here. They got U.S. puppet. Well, they're going to give the money from Citgo to Guido. Well, that's a seizure of assets, you see. Seizure of assets, and that's what, and it has to do with dollar availability, doesn't it? You know, if Citgo does not remit its profits, its revenues, the profits back to Venezuela in dollars, because oil is traded in dollars only globally. Another tactic is to impose sanctions on Venezuela to prohibit it from selling its oil globally. Again, oil is sold in dollars. So if Citgo can't sell its oil globally, if Venezuela can't sell its oil globally, then that source of dollars is denied it as well. And the U.S. is putting the strong arm on all these countries that purchase Venezuelan oil, including U.S. refiners, you see, in Texas and so forth, right? Cutting that off. Well, it's all about cutting off the flow of dollars, creating a further shortage of dollars, further inflation, and therefore the inability to purchase goods, key goods, you know, like medicine and food. Oh, you can purchase it, but your dollars are so, I mean, your bolivars are worth so little, you can hardly buy any, because you could only buy it in dollars, and you got to, you know, use your bolivars, which are worth less in relationship to dollars, to buy this stuff, these foodstuffs and medicines and so forth. So what does the Venezuelan government have to do? It just has to create more bolivars, right? If it wants to buy the medicines and foodstuff. Well, what you're doing then is causing a further depreciation of the exchange rate. I mean, they have no choice. If the dollars are being squeezed out and you need dollars for trade, well, then you pump even more bolivars so you can buy this stuff, you know, buy dollars to buy the goods. And then they say, well, you know, it's mismanagement of the economy by these folks. You know, even intellectuals are buying that because they don't understand the economics of this. Well, yeah, they've pumped the excess currency, their currency, bolivars, into the economy, which is contributing to the inflation. But they have no choice because they've been deprived of dollars, both through the sale of their oil, both through borrowing from global financial institutions, both from their Citgo subsidiary in the U.S. That cannot remit dollars any further. Or they freeze other assets as well. And not just of the government, they freeze assets of Venezuelan businessmen and others in the government as a threat. So they don't let it go through the individual private channels either. They don't let money come back that way, right? So they freeze and seize the assets. Or if they don't have the money to pay their debts already, corporations and the government there, because the debts have to be prepaid in dollars, and they don't have the dollars, right? Well, then they force these companies to default. And if they default, they go out of business. If they go out of business, they lay off all their workers. So you get massive unemployment, unless the government steps in and employs these people directly. Yeah, but how's the government going to pay them when it has a problem with its finances as well? You see, Venezuela, 95% of all the government finances comes from the sale of oil. So if you see Citgo and you impose sanctions on anybody who wants to buy Venezuelan oil, you deny them the dollars necessary to keep them, meaning Venezuelan corporations, to keep paying their principal and interest on their debt, and they default and they go under and so forth, right? Another way is the U.S. Denies Venezuela and other countries access to what's called the SWIFT system. This is the U.S.-dominated and controlled financial network, by which currencies are exchanged for other currencies in making payments, you see, SWIFT payments. You move your money around through the SWIFT system. They're doing the same thing with Iran. So access to the SWIFT system slows down and prevents, being able to take even your excess bolivars to buy dollars to pay your bills. And then we have an ideological offensive here that goes, Venezuela is so corrupt. Venezuela is so inept in its economy, managing its economy, causing all this, terrible conditions for its people. Yeah, well, it's behind the scenes the U.S. is engineering all this, right? And then they say unfair elections. Well, they were international and observed elections last year, and no one said anything about being unfair then, right? And then now we have direct political intervention, which has been going on for some time, but now it's intensifying under Bolton and Pompeo. You got all kind of NGO front groups there being fed dollars by the U.S. And now they set up this, trying to get this humanitarian aid in through the Colombian border and probably through the Brazilian border too. Well, that's all about co-opting the local Venezuelan populace, with bribes and freebies. And once that happens, then you can send the proxy military over the border to establish a base inside the country, proxy military like the Colombian military and certainly the Brazilian military, right? They get a base. Humanitarian aid is about a way of opening a window and a door to get their military in, and then the locals will not resist, you see, because they'll be dependent on this aid. And then, once you get your military proxy forces established within the boundary of Venezuela, then you can expand that whole thing. And you break off a sector, larger sector, ever larger sector of the country, and you set up an alternative government in that other sector, and now you got a civil war if the army doesn't break. Okay, so that's where they're going now. That's what all this humanitarian aid is about. You buy off union leaders to create strikes and so forth. You buy off judges, right? You finance elections, the opposition in elections. The U.S. is really, they complain about Russia, but they do it, in extreme everywhere else. Okay, that's the signal. I think we're out of time here. I'll be writing more on financial imperialism, the case of Venezuela. Check out my blog here in the next few days at jackrasmus.com, and we'll talk to you next week.